98FM's Now That's What I Call Sport podcast.
If you are a young aspiring footballer, a parent, a coach, an agent, or anyone else with an interest in the journey young Irish teens, English teens, and so on go through to chase their dreams in UK soccer academies, you better take a listen to this. I'm delighted to welcome author and presenter of No Hunger in Paradise, an award-winning book and very recent TV documentary on BT Sport, Mike Calvin, back to 98FM again. Mike, how are you?
I'm very well, Jamie. You?
Great, thanks, Mike. Thanks very much for joining us. I know you spoke to us last year about your book about football managers living on a volcano. You have a new book and TV show out on BT Sport, and one of the opening lines in the documentary is from a parent of an 8-year-old kid at Chelsea who turned down 7 other Premier League clubs. And her quote is, "I'm anxious about the life I'm pushing my child into." Mike, for those who are unaware of what that life that the parents are either pushing the kids into, but the life that many of these kids, if not all of them, dream about every night, tell us what that life is actually like in the UK for a young kid in an academy.
Well, I suppose it crosses borders, the dream, and it's, you know, I try to understand the power of that great dream that is essentially about overcoming the odds and becoming a professional footballer. And what odds? If you look at it in the English context, only 180 of the 1.5 million boys who play organised youth football in England at any one time will become a Premier League pro, i.e. they'll play a minute in the Premier League. Now, that's a success rate of 0.012%. And similarly, you know, I don't wish to rain on the parade of the mums and dads who are probably listening to this, taking their kids to you know, the Sunday morning matches, but less than half of 1% of boys who enter academies at the age of 9 will make a living from the game. So those dropout rates are terrifying, and I suppose it begs the question, which I've tried to address in the book and the film, is who picks up the pieces? Because even the survivors, those ones who go through the system and actually make a living out of the game, probably need better guidance and more structured advice, because it's quite an under-regulated world, populated by agents. Parents get ahead of themselves far too often. And, you know, essentially, I suppose, in a phrase, what I tried to ask was, look, what is football doing to our kids?
Yes, and Mike, the question posed in the documentary is, do the academy kids themselves and the parents understand how tough the industry actually is? It's described by one of your contributors as a brutal environment. What is that environment actually like, if you can try and take us inside a UK academy for a young Irish or English kid who's 14, 15, 16, who's just starting off? They think they're going to go and live their dream, but for a lot of them, as we said, the stats say not too many make it. It's a very difficult environment to be in.
Yeah, well, to be honest, Jamie, you talk about 14, 15, 16, and that is one aspect of it. What is actually happening, because there's now a race to the bottom going on in professional football, it's about finding that golden child as young as possible. You know, there are instances of a 3-year-old being approached by a club. Certainly, and, you know, and that's not typical, but that has happened. But there, you know, we have what we call now the pre-academy phase, which is boys between the ages of 6 and 9. The recruitment there is more cutthroat almost than it is at senior level. And, you know, you hear of, you know, coaches, when I was doing the research, coaches were talking about a 9-year-old boy being paid £24,000 a year through his parents, completely illicitly. But these stories are too common to be dismissed as pure fantasy, and they come from very, very reliable sources. What you have, if you try and take as an example, let's take the northwest of England. Even the smaller clubs like, you know, Crewe Alexandra have got a history of producing young players. But in that sort of conurbation, the Manchester Liverpool area, there are boys, and I've spoken to their parents, who are 5 and 6 years old, and they will go to Manchester United one night, Manchester City next, Everton the next, Liverpool the next. They're picked up from school and they're eating in the back of the car on the way to a session. And I think when you have that concentration and a mania for young talent, they're boys, they're children. You know, let's get that 100% right. And you hear of parents who, frankly, you know, make me shudder sometimes. And I'm speaking as a parent whose son went through the academy system, and they have a completely unreal view of what is going to occur. They think that that riches are guaranteed, that fame is a near certainty. Well, it's not. You know, we've already talked about the figures, but it's the stress that it puts on the boys. And it's, you know, I've heard of, you know, parents putting floodlights in the back garden so little Jimmy can kick a ball around in the winter at 8 o'clock at night.
Well,
you know, you hear of, you know, there's one parent who's apparently put down a 3G pitch in his garden for the same sort of reason. There is a huge pressure on these boys very early on, and it manifests itself in, there's a really good phrase which I think is really applicable in this sense. It's premature professionalism.
Yeah.
So by that, I mean, if you look at the boy who signed up an academy at 9, he's encouraged to believe, maybe subliminally, but certainly, you know, by some very unwise parents, that this is your job. And so you treat that as a job from, say, 9 until 16, when the occasion comes where you're either kept on as a scholar or you're lost. When that happens, a lot of boys get to see. I was talking to Sean Dysher about this a couple of weeks ago, and Sean made the point. He sees boys get to, say, 16, and essentially all the joy and the life has been sucked out of them because it's been they've had to deal with the pressure of this being their job, in inverted commas, from the age of 9. They get to 16 and there's nothing left. They're overwhelmed. Now, that same boy, if he was given more time to be a boy, to be a child, to be someone who plays multi-sports, who has a normal social life with his school friends, who is encouraged to cultivate extra interests, who is told the importance of education, a longer education, a much more balanced lifestyle, those boys are now beginning to appear at, say, 18, and they've fallen out of the professional systems, but actually they bounce back, these type of boys, because they haven't had that day in, day out, you must be a mini pro. Just like we're expecting boys to be mini adults, it just does not work.
Yes, and you know, this documentary mainly, Mike, is based on kids in the UK, but I can assure you there are parents exactly the same in Ireland who have the floodlights in the garden, who have the AstroTurf in the garden, who have the kids doing everything that they can at the age of 8, 9 or 10 to try and become a young professional. And, you know, a lot of these kids do go from Ireland to the UK at 15 or 16. And again, the stats in favour of them making it are also very, very slim. You mentioned a 9-year-old being paid 24 grand a year through his parents. You mentioned the pre-academy recruitment of 3-year-olds, and another story in the documentary of a 13-year-old who's offered a guaranteed pro contract of £45,000 a week, and even some parents smuggling agents into the training grounds in their cars. And that does make it out at times to be a kind of a dark industry in terms of what goes on behind the scenes by these clubs and the agents and the parents to try and get these kids.
It is, you know, that, to be completely fair, the biggest clubs and the best structures, you know, they do try and educate the kids. The problem is that it's an under-regulated, anarchic world, and you hear, you know, anecdotally of agents arranging transfers for 12-year-olds between academies. You know, you're not meant to have an agent until you're 16, but they are operating almost in plain sight. You have boot deals being arranged while they're still schoolboys. There is a in the film, an Irish agent, a really, really good guy called Alan Redmond, spoke very honestly about his profession. And, his view very much is that if there's a boy of 14, 15, whose potential becomes glaringly obvious, these people attract, or these boys attract, piranhas, to use his phrase. And that is where I think the game is failing in its duty of care, because in essence, 14, 15, just coming either, in that sort of puberty, post-pubescent era, boys don't know their own bodies, they don't know their own minds, they've got half-formed characters, yet there are people who are preying on them. And it's regrettable, but you have to include their parents in that sometimes. That there are some brilliant parents out there. I met some fantastic parents who've got their kids' welfare at heart. But there are those who are carried away by what one coach called to me, told me of. He said, "Look, it's the gravy. They're interested in the gravy. These people put up with stuff in football that if it happened in their school environment, they'd be straight to see the headmaster. Yet because it's football and there's money at the end of the rainbow, they let it go." And I think the other thing that people probably fail to appreciate is that ambition is not an individual thing. The ambition for the boy means that essentially it consumes his entire family. So you go to academy matches and you see entire family groups, baby buggies in tow, three or four kids, three or siblings, who basically turn up for football because the golden child, the one who could well be their meal ticket or the family meal ticket, is playing. And so they go to training sessions. They go to matches. So they're as much a part of the process as the boy himself. And, again, what I try and do is the old Mandela thing, isn't it? Walk a step in another man's shoes.
Yeah.
Try and put yourself in the position of a 13-year-old boy who knows that his family's welfare depends on him making it as a pro. Now, that is an inhuman type of pressure to put on a boy of that age. Yeah, it's there. It might be unspoken, but it's there. It's in the back of people's minds.
It certainly is. We're speaking to author and TV documentary maker Mike Calvin here on 98FM on Sunday. He's just put a brilliant documentary on BT Sport called No Hunger in Paradise, written a book by the same name, all about children, and they are children, in English football academies, both English, Irish and so on, trying to make it, and just the road that they have to travel to do so. Mike, let's stay in the theme of parents for now, and parents living out their own dreams through their children. And we spoke already about agents and coaches, and a lot of these academies have lots of coaches and sports psychologists and all of the above, a lot of whom can be very good. But you make the point in the documentary about the amount of voices in the ears of these young players, and they're unable to think or make any choices for themselves because they've got so many people with an interest in them telling them so many different things.
Yeah, what I found interesting, Jamie, during the filming, we went to the Brit School, which produced Adele, Amy Winehouse, dancers, performers. And it was a really interesting contrast in atmosphere and ethos between that sort of arts-based, it's a school, but it's actually an academy, and the football academy. And the principal, a guy called Stuart Warden, it actually came across brilliantly, I thought, in the film. And he made the point that, when he's been approached by football clubs, his study of their culture is that football is essentially a culture of fear. Whereas the Brit School, performing arts, want to create an environment of freedom. And he made the point that the young footballer has far too many voices in his ear. He has the parent, he has the coach, he has the academy manager, he has an agent. he has maybe a stylist, whatever it is. And at that age, and when you're at that age, you cannot, you know, you cannot have that many voices in your ear. And in artistic terms, what they do is divorce the boys and girls from the industry for which they're being prepared, whereas football basically hits them smack on in the face with, look, you know, you're in a harsh, highly commercialised business, just happens to be called professional football. And I put that sort of contrast to Les Reed, who is the basically defines all the football policy at Southampton, which is a very good academy, and he agreed with it. He said, you know, that there are two types of voices in a child's ear or a boy's ear, and you know, the most pernicious one and the quite common one is one who have the one from people who have an ulterior motive. They want something from that boy. What they try to do as an institution at Southampton, and as I say, other enlightened academies do the same, similar things, is to almost become surrogate parents, so that they actually take a broader view of the lifestyle, of the demands that are placed on a boy, because their view very much is that beyond the sort of financial advantages of selling homegrown players in the sort of medium to long term, when you have a homegrown player at a football club, it increases the sense of identity of that football club and the bond, it reinforces the bond between the supporters and the team, which, you know, we live in an age in professional football where certainly at Premier League clubs, the player has never been further away spiritually, financially, from the supporters who we like to think pay their wages, but they don't, because we all know that the TV companies pay their wages now.
Yes, and we have to say as well, we're not totally having a go at the academies. The academies in general, certainly the top ones, as you said, Mike, the players are treated well. The facilities are second to none. I know of a young player travelling up to an FA Youth Cup game this week. They're going to stay in a hotel overnight. They're going on a fantastic Ellison's coach with Sky Sports News, coffee machines, all you can think of. But again, the question is, when they reach the end of their first contract, or if they're lucky enough to get a second contract, what happens next? And that's the final part I'd like to focus on with you, Mike. And you mentioned the Brit school and the absence of fear that those children are developed under. Who's there when the tears fall and the dream dissolves is a question you ask. And does football pay attention to the duty of care it has for these young people? One answer was absolutely nothing about lifestyle advice given to players. And for a boy as young as six to be discarded for having bad habits. So what happens next to these kids, whether they be 6, 16, even 20? I know there's a couple of young men in the documentary who are maybe a little bit older when they get released. What happens to them support-wise from clubs, from PFA and that sort of stuff, or is it just left to them and their parents to literally pick up the pieces of a dream that they feel has been shattered?
Yeah, I don't think the PFA do a good enough job, to be quite frank, in that area. There is an organisation I've seen work, and as a result of the film and the documentary, I think a lot more people are aware of what they do. They're called the Players Trust, and it's an independent, not-for-profit organisation which offers sort of mentorship programmes, but essentially what they do is offer free, instantly available, confidential counselling services. So they're not part of the club structure or the football system, and that's really important, because time and again you hear when you speak to people in the academy structures, and this is parents, that they feel that they don't have a voice, because if they do voice their misgivings, or they don't turn up for training because, I don't know, a family wedding or whatever, that will be held against them. And I do think it's fair to say that football ritually, at all levels, exploits fear and insecurity. So these Players Trust people, and I've put some parents in touch with them who had issues, and they were very, very effective. Just to put basically, they had some seed funding from Sir Alex Ferguson, who saw the need for that sort of transitional support for young players who are going out of the game. And as you mentioned rightly, Jamie, it's 6-22. Arsene Wenger spoke very well in the film about the morality of the whole process. And he made the point also that two-thirds of the boys who are given a pro contract at 19 are out of the game by the time they're 22. They are, in essence, bodies who are put in to sustain what was under 21 is now under 23 football. And that hints at the central issue, and it was raised in the film by a guy called Phil Giles, who's Brentford's director of football, where he comes from a non-football background, mathematician by training, and he said, look, you know, could you imagine the moral outcry if, say, for instance, the banks hoovered up all the young boys in their area, trained them in, I don't know, foreign exchange dealing or whatever it is, and then started buying and selling those boys? That, in essence, is exactly what's happening in football. And people say, oh, well, it's football, isn't it? Well, you know, is that a good enough response? I think also the other thing is, the one thing that Wenger said is that some of those 22-year-olds who are released and have got nowhere to go, they're probably millionaires.
Yeah.
And they've never kicked a ball for the first team because there is this mania, we can't afford to miss the golden child, so therefore they get to 17, 18, and they are paid, you know, extraordinarily well for someone of that age. No one bats an eyelid now when you hear a 17-year-old on £10,000 or £20,000 a week. You know, I know of one who was on £36,000 a week at 17. Now, yep. I don't know about you, Jamie, but that would blow my head off.
Yes.
As an adult. So it's an area which I think in some ways reflects the ills of the senior game. That sort of greed, the almost immorality of it, and it's the, well, let's just care about today and forget about tomorrow.
Yeah, and some other interesting contributors on the documentary, former manager and now a car salesman who owns a garage, Brian Laws, talks about you know, a kid getting a lotto ticket and given millionaire status when he has never played a first team game. What other industry would do that? Steven Gerrard asked a question about, do these young players still have the hunger and determination to be pros? And a really powerful quote from Joey Barton, who apparently made a speech to an academy at one time and basically said to the kids, are you going to come in and take my jersey? I'm playing in the first team. Are you coming to take my jersey? And as you mentioned about Phil Giles from Brentford, along with Huddersfield, about closed down their academies because they felt that it didn't make business sense to run an academy, spend so much money, with the stats not in favour of these players making it. Mike, I love how you finished the documentary. The very final quote says, football is a people business that doesn't always treat people well. Celebrate achievement, cherish the dream, protect the innocent, is how you chose to finish off the movie.
Yeah, and they are innocent, and I think that's the thing that's often forgotten in the whole process. The young boys who have a modicum of talent and they have a life stretching before them, and their life won't be defined in the vast majority of cases by the fact that whether or not they play professional football. They're kids, treat them as kids and just let them play.
That's the voice of Mike Calvin, the author and the maker of the TV documentary No Hunger in Paradise. And Mike, people, if they want to read the book is very in-depth. They'll find it in all good bookstores, and the BT documentary, I'm sure they'll find online. It's definitely on the BT Sport website and on YouTube as well. And it's well worth a watch or a read. Mike, thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And Mike, very finally, what's next in the pipeline for yourself? You're a man who writes very interesting sports books and exposés. Is there anything else of interest that's coming for you in 2018?
Yeah, I've got a couple of projects on the go. I've got a book which is going to come out, hopefully, because I've only just started writing it, in August, and it's called State of Play, and it's essentially a hopefully a snapshot of football in all its forms in 2018. And it harks back to a seminal football book. It was the first book that my dad ever bought me, called The Football Man by Arthur Hopcraft. That was published in 1968, so this is football 50 years on.
Mike Calvin, thanks so much. We'll speak to you soon.
Pleasure.
98FM's Now That's What I Call Sport.
Back live this Sunday morning from 9.
98FM.